Thanks. Matthew, thanks for inviting me. I really love to come here every time. And only a few days ago, I realized I gave a colloquium here only maybe less than 3 years ago. So I was going to talk more about many-body localization, but then I realized I gave it in my previous colloquium also, although maybe many of you were not there. So I'll talk about something. I'll talk a little bit about many-body localization, but mainly about more recent interests regarding actually thermalization, which is almost the opposite of many-body. It's really the opposite of many-body localization. So I'll talk about things that I thought about in collaboration and discussion with many of these people, and also in a collaboration with a great experimental group, Emmanuel Bloch's group. Good. Oops. What happened here? So, yeah. As Matthew said, I was interested in cold atoms for a long time, and actually, that kind of motivated me to look more seriously into quantum dynamics, because these experiments, although they're cold atoms, if you look at the temperatures in these experiments with respect to natural scales in the system, they're actually not so cold. They're much, much hotter than condensed matter experiments. What is different there is that, because for example, all the scales are much lower. So although the temperature is lower, the Fermi energy and the degeneracy temperature, they're also much lower. So in that respect, they're not necessarily extremely cold, but what they are is they're extremely isolated. And being extremely isolated from the environment without any kind of noise from the environment, phonons, any bath they're connected to, one can study kind of pristine dynamics of the system. Another thing they know how to do very well is prepare an initial state that they can control very well and then see its dynamics. So this is an example of dynamics of fermions in an optical lattice. It's just a schematic illustration. I'll show you a real experiment in a minute. And this is an experiment where you look at quantum dynamics, but actually of an integrable model which never thermalizes. And you can study the, or actually nearly integrable model. And you can study what happens when you put on perturbations to an integrable model. So there are many new questions you can ask about the dynamics of a quantum system. And here are some of these questions. One, at least there are many more, but some of the questions that have intrigued me is how does a thermalization occur in a closed quantum system when the system is just undergoing its own dynamics? And what does it mean? How does it occur? As physicists, we want to be able to somehow classify it like we have been able to classify phases of matter at low temperatures. Can we also classify systems by the way in which they thermalize in some sense? I'll show that partially we can. Then the question is, another question is, what role, if at all, is played by quantum effects in this thermalization? Can we think of these quantum systems for all purposes as just being classical? Or does entanglement and other quantum effects play a role, an important role? Also, what is the role of chaos, and what does it mean to be quantum chaotic in thermalization? Because in a thermalization of a classical system, we think that chaos plays a big role in basically making everything forget its initial state. Also, is thermalization and emergent behavior of classical behavior inevitable fate of any quantum system that is undergoing some dynamical evolution, or can you evade it and remain quantum for a long or even infinite time, meaning that you can have quantum correlations that are measurable and different from classical correlations over a long period of time? And finally, these are kind of abstract, theoretical questions, and then maybe practically, can we compute anything related to quantum dynamics of a many-body system? So these questions would be at the focus of my talk, but I want to start from actually showing you two experiments that give very sharp, interesting results pertaining to thermalization that maybe motivate asking these questions on some concrete level and some concrete sense. So I'll start with these experiments, then I'll talk about One is related to transport in bad metals. Another is related to many body localization. Then I'll discuss this question of computability of dynamics in quantum systems. What does it take to be able to compute dynamics? And then I'll show you some results of some scheme that is based on a new idea of how to compute dynamics. Okay, so first, experiment, a very recent experiment from Princeton group by Wasim Bakker. They have a really nice apparatus where they can, it's called a quantum gas microscope, where they can really look at their atoms in situ and see what they're doing. And they also have an ability to control them and impose initial states at very high resolution. So what they do here is they really impose this kind of initial state that has a density modulation. You see it here, it's this density modulation. And they see how this density modulation fades away with time, okay? Now they can impose such density modulation. You see an example of one wavelength, but they can see, they can change the wavelength of the modulation, making it larger and larger wavelength, or smaller and smaller wave vector, and measure the relaxation time, tau, as a function of this wave vector. And from this, you can extract the diffusion constant, okay? So what they've done really is by measuring the dynamics, they can extract a diffusion constant of this system. The nice thing is that this system is it's a strongly interacting Fermi gas on a lattice, Fermi fluid on a lattice. It has no small parameter. The interactions are of the same order as the tunneling matrix element. And this is it's a ubiquitous, or it's a very popular model. It's basically the Hubbard model that is very popular for describing strongly correlated materials. And here is the result they get. Somehow this is not working now. Oh, okay, some delay. Okay, so the result they get, they by measuring the diffusion constant and independently the compressibility of the system, they can extract conductivity or resistivity and measure it as a function of temperature. And what you see here is the temperature in units of either the tunneling or the, I think it's units of the tunneling. And so here is approximately where the system becomes degenerate, either around here. So you can see they can go easily to high temperatures and less easily to low temperatures below the degeneracy temperature. But the interesting thing is that the resistivity seems to go linearly, and both at very high temperatures and at much lower temperatures, and approximately with the same slope. This is very interesting because it compares in kind of an interesting way to what people are seeing in systems of strongly correlated electrons. For example, the high TC coup rates. This is a famous experiment that shows in temperature rise of the resistivity. And again, it goes with the same slope both at low temperature and higher temperatures. Here, of course, it cannot go even close to the degeneracy temperature. All of this is in a much, much lower temperature regime. In both cases, though, this linear slope seems to go almost uninterrupted through some unit of resistance called a Joffe-Regel limit, or quantum resistance. Resistivity, which seems to suggest that the system cannot really be described using weakly coupled quasi-classical quasi-particles. So the interesting thing is that this gives us new information about this problem of strange metals that behave in this way and have linear in temperature resistivity down to very, very, all the way down to low temperatures. So why is this special? This is why they're called strange metals. I found this. This is apparently a Korean movie, The Good, Bad, and the Weird. So So I put it in perspective. So if I wanted to put copper, which is a good metal, at the same scale, the resistivity would be somewhere here, okay? And so this has much, much, much faster scattering than copper. And the temperature dependence is linear, while in copper at very low temperatures, it would be mainly due to phonons T to the fifth. There may be a small T squared behavior initially, but it's weakly interacting, so I'm not sure it's seen very well. But anyways, you see a huge difference between these good metals, which never come close to this quantum of resistive, this Joffe-Regge limit, and these systems. And this linear behavior seems to suggest that the lifetime of quasi-particles, or the thermalization time in the system, local thermalization time, is just limited by temperature. This is what people call Planckian relaxation, the fastest thermalization you can have. Actually, if you really put numbers into this, it looks like this is something like two orders of magnitude even faster than Planckian. So I'm not even sure that Planckian is really the correct limit here. But anyways, what it means is that semi-classical, simple Boltzmann transport in terms of weakly interacting quasi-particles completely fails in these systems. I'm back to the question, can we compute or explain such very, very fast thermalization dynamics that give rise to very fast relaxation and very large resistivity in the end, and linear dependence in temperature? Can we describe such dynamics in some unbiased way? So I'll come back to that a little bit later. Now I want to show a second experiment that gives some kind of interesting non-trivial information. This is done in Emmanuel Bloch's group. I've also been involved in this experiment. And what they measure, they look at, again, a Fermi system, fermions in a lattice. This time it's a one-dimensional lattice. They can hop, they have interactions, and they impose initially, and there is some disorder. In fact, in this case, it's not true disorder, it's a quasi-periodic detuning that makes it look almost random, but it's not really random. They, again, exactly the same as in the other experiment, they impose some periodicity density modulation initially, and then see how the system relaxes, and there is a huge difference. What happens, it's sufficiently strong disorder, is that this density modulation simply doesn't relax, okay? It just stays. This is a complete breakdown of ergodicity. It means that the system, even though it's a finite energy density, if it thermalized, it would have thermalized to finite temperature, maybe even close to infinite temperature, or in some units here. Well, let's not say infinite temperature here, but it's high temperature compared to the natural scales here. This would be a perfect insulator at some finite energy density or temperature. And this is what Basco, Lehner, and Altshuler and these people predicted would be a many-body localized phase. So just as I said, I promise I won't talk about it a lot, but just as a very, very quick, brief reminder, this is Anderson's localization dealt with a single particle state that is, for sufficiently strong disorder, will remain localized in spite of being able to tunnel to other sites. The idea is that for sufficiently strong disorder in any dimension, if the disorder is sufficiently large, there is going to be a vanishing probability of resonances at sufficiently large scale. So you will not get transport through the system. Now, if you add interactions, you can see naively that the interaction term, if you put the system in an eigenstate of the localized system, the interaction will now make the particles hop. And the question is whether this state will be stable to interactions. In fact, it's a much more subtle question, because when you add interactions, without interaction, this particle has to choose between n possible resonances, where the n is the number of, say, other wells. But if I have interactions, then I have a many-body system with, say, n electrons in L sites. There are 2 to the L, approximately. There is the number of total number of states in the Hilbert space scales like exponentially with the system size. And then the opportunity for resonance, you can find resonances, many-body resonances, within this huge Hilbert space. So really, it's a fundamentally different problem once you include interactions. But now again, I don't get this. Sorry. Okay, but these people actually argued convincingly that, in fact, as long as you don't go to as you stay in sufficiently low energies, the localization persists, and then there is a critical temperature or energy scale on which you go to a delocalized phase. And then later it was understood that if you take a system with a bounded spectrum, like a spin system, then you can be localized even at infinite temperature and drive a localization, delocalization transition as a function of this order strength. Okay? So all of this tells us that actually, I told you about classification of dynamics, so now we already know how to classify closed system dynamics into two robust paradigms. One is thermalization, in which basically you start with some, in a thermalizing system, if I start with some quantum correlations in my system, say I entangled some two particles there, because of the dynamics, this entanglement will rapidly get lost as the system gets entangled with all the rest of the degrees of freedom. And the only surviving degrees of freedom are slow conserved densities, which are classical structures, and they're described by classical hydrodynamics. So you have, because of thermalization, you have emergent classical behavior. The other paradigm that I just talked about a little bit is many-body localization, in which local quantum information actually can persist indefinitely. What I showed you in these experiments is local information, which is classical, persisting forever, but it has been shown that even if you encode some bit, quantum bit, into the system, you let it evolve in time, that bit dephases, but with local operations, you can echo it back even after infinitely long time. You can at least echo part of it back. So this is really a completely new paradigm for a long time steady state of matter, where now, even at long times, you need to take into account a quantum description of the dynamics. While for thermalizing systems at long times, they behave classically like usual systems we know from real world. They're fundamentally quantum at the small scales, but they become classical when you look at them at long times and long scales. So in that sense, it's very interesting to study the many-body localization transition, because it might afford us some controlled view of what is thermalization. It's also a sharp boundary between a world that obeys quantum mechanics and one that basically is classical at long scales. And also it's maybe an opportunity to study what is thermalization with a control that we have with a critical point. The only thing is we need to understand this critical point. And so far there is only rudimentary understanding of it. But there are already some experiments, so the same group actually had an experiment that focused at the vicinity of the transition, where you can see, again, these relaxation curves starting from an initial density modulation that they imposed on the system, and they see how this relaxes. And you see that the relaxation becomes slower and slower as you get closer to the transition, as you increase the disorder from this white blue to dark blue. And again, the question is, can we compute this and understand, can we understand the universal behavior close to the transition? Wow. Maybe I can. Um, Okay, so the goal is to be able to compute dynamics of a strongly coupled system that's not described by some weak coupling Boltzmann type semi-classical transport. One example of this are disordered systems near the many-body localization transition. Another example are these strange metals, like the cuprates that have this linear in temperature resistivity. And another example are dynamics close to quantum critical point. So let's try to understand what we so far know generally about dynamics of these systems, so at least believe we understand. So at short times, what happens is we have unitary evolution, and there is an onset of quantum chaos if the system is thermalizing. This is what I term here quantum butterflies from the butterfly effect. And recently, they've been characterized by out-of-time order correlators. So what is an out-of-time order correlator? You have two operators at two points in the system, and you look at the growth of the correlator squared between them. So I want to give you some sense, intuitive sense, of what this is measuring. There are many ways to give intuitive sense of that. Here is one I kind of like. So imagine this is the x-axis, and I apply some operator, say a bosonic operator, a dagger I, at this point I. And the operator now follows some unitary evolution. Okay, so the unitary evolution, you can think of that operator as a state in some super Hilbert space where the operators are states. So it becomes a superposition, say, of AI and a dagger I minus one and a dagger I plus one. But because the evolution is has some interactions, it has some small probability, let's say epsilon, of splitting into three operators. Okay? So after some time, you take this branch, say the branch with I minus one, this is this branch. After some time, this branch continues, but at some point, you might have, of course, it's superposed with many, many other world. You know, you can have all the possible histories. It's quantum mechanics of this operator. But I'm showing one history. It branches into three, like here, and then, you know, each branch has the same, it continues and continues. And this is obviously an exponential process. So you can ask, what happens to the commutator of this operator, AJ, with that operator that I let evolve in time, right? So at short times, they commute. Now, after some time, when this front reaches, then they don't commute. But here you see this operator is still very dilute. It may be split three times. So the commutation relation between them is not very large. It becomes the largest it can possibly be, which is essentially one, when basically it has a probability one of hitting an operator, when it becomes ultra dense here, right? And so what happens is basically you get some, because of this exponential process, you expect this exponential growth until it saturates to one later on. Yeah, okay, right. So this diagram is, yeah, it's a little bit schematic, but the idea behind this diagram is you take one history of there, you have to superpose all possible histories, okay, of this operation. This is a quantum superposition, right? So I'm looking at the history where this one split into three operators, but then at every step, this is a step and you have to repeat that. Every time step you repeat. Right? Again, you apply the unitaries. So when you repeat, you have, again, you have three histories that continue, and then each one of them can split at some point into three, right? So that's an exponential process. So I'm looking at one history out of the many, many, many. But, you know, each one of them is typical, right? And so this one is a typical history, right? So eventually it will become a dense operator, and then this commutation relation will be one. But when it's still very dilute operator, you get exponential. You'd expect to see some exponential growth. So this is the basic. one, at least my intuitive picture of how you can get this kind of exponential growth. And it really has to do with the flow of information from local degrees of freedom. If you encoded some information to the initial state of this operator, it was not just a dagger, then this initial information encoded locally will become extremely non-local and encoded into a huge superposition of string operators that are highly, highly, highly non-local. So it's slightly different than the concept of chaos in classical mechanics, because it's really due to exponential proliferation in the Hilbert space rather than non-linearity is what causing this kind of exponential growth. So that's what I call a quantum butterfly. Although it has nothing to do with classical nonlinearity, this is somehow eventually giving rise to the classical behavior later on. But before that, I wanted to make a comment that recently there has been a lot of progress in understanding this type of correlation function, and there has even been a quantum bound on how fast this can grow. And again, this kind of Planckian bound comes in, but this time it's really a bound. It's not like in the timescale for thermalization. For this Lyapunov exponent associated with the growth of this out of time order correlation, there's been a proven bound under some conditions. And people understand now that the chaotic front that I showed you propagates ballistically, like what I showed before, and it's characterized by a velocity people call the butterfly velocity. And there are some conjectured relations which are not clearly correct, but they might be correct in some regimes, between this characteristic of chaos and transport coefficients. So this is related to the second stage of quantum thermalization. So the first stage basically served to convert this unitary evolution to not irreversible classical evolution. And the way it did that, it took information that was present in local, classically accessible degrees of freedom into highly non-local ones where it's essentially lost to any local observation. And therefore, you get effectively, for all local observables, you get effectively irreversible evolution. You get basically hydrodynamics. So all the slow modes eventually are just described by diffusion equations for conserved quantities. In this case, I just have, suppose I have just energy density as my conserved density, then I have diffusion of energy. And if I put on, I inject some energy locally into my system, that local energy will diffuse. Okay, so we have two stages. One is kind of new now, people are newly interested in it. It's the kind of setup stage, which is still quantum, more or less, and is the flow of operators from small to complicated. And that sets the stage to the initial to the emergence of classical hydrodynamics in a thermalizing system. And the question is whether we can calculate these two stages so that we get from first principles because this diffusion constant is not something I know. One needs to calculate it, and it does involve quantum processes. So quantum processes basically determine this diffusion constant, for example. So you could say, no, if I'm interested in long scales, maybe I can just phenomenologically get this, write some diffusion equation. But what if I have a very interesting and non-trivial behavior of this diffusion constant, like in the case of strange metals, how do I get it from a calculation? Okay, so still not working. So why is this hard? Why can't we just solve the Schrödinger equation? Of course, the reason is that the Hilbert space dimension grows exponentially with system size. And this exponential increase with system size compared to classical systems is, of course, because of entanglement, right? Because if I had just product states, no entanglement, then I would completely specify my state with n numbers, or n, at least n times some constant numbers which specify the state of each local variable, right? This is classical physics. Because it's not true, we have entanglement. Entanglement makes the due to the entanglement, the Hilbert space dimension is huge. The number of states we have to keep. So, but why is this not a problem for some at least some models for calculating ground states or thermodynamics? Because for that, for many models, we have quantum Monte Carlo that works great, and it works great for calculating thermodynamic properties. It cannot calculate real-time dynamics. There is also something that I'll get into a little bit more. DMRG is another numerical approach that was pioneered in the 90s by Steve White. And it utilizes the fact that quantum ground states have very low entanglement, have only area low entanglement. The problem is that, as you saw in this dynamics of operators, what happens is that the operators become more and more complex, more and more entangled as time goes on. And because of that, basically, the folklore is that DMRG should fail. Okay, and this is something I want to actually look at critically. So first, what is entanglement entropy? Because it's a colloquium, maybe some people here are from another field. In our field, it's been such a popular thing to look at. But if I have a quantum system, basically I take a reduced density matrix of some subsystem A, trace rho log rho, von Neumann entropy, that's called the entanglement entropy. And that would be zero if this whole state is a product state of the state of A and the state of the rest, because, yeah, then if I trace out the rest of the system, A is still in one pure state. So for one pure state, the entropy is, of course, zero. So there is no entanglement entropy if there is no entanglement. Physical Hamiltonians happen to have very low entanglement. There is no theorem, but at least in certain situations in 1D, one knows that they have area low entanglement, which means in one dimension, it's just a constant. And constant entanglement can be encoded very efficiently using a class of states called matrix product states. This is the essence of the DMRG that I told you about by Stephen White. The idea is that these matrix product states can encode states with area law entanglement, or in one dimension, area law is just constant entanglement, and the amount of entanglement they can capture is, so this is a matrix product state. If you haven't seen one, it doesn't matter. It's almost like it's a generalization of a product state. A product state is just a classical state that has no entanglement. Now, if you generalize it to have, instead of at each site, a superposition between two local states with two different C numbers, you make the superposition of the two local up state and down state with a matrix in front instead of a C number, you get a matrix product state, and that gives you allows you to capture entanglement between the local site and other distant sites, and the scale on which it captures entanglement is log of the of this dimension chi. So maximal entanglement entropy of this state is log of chi. So in fact, it's like it's taking into account the full Hilbert space of a segment of length log chi. Okay. So this is the idea of DMRG, and the reason I'm talking about it, because you would want to try to use it for time dependence. You can also evolve these matrix product states in time. The problem is that the entanglement entropy would grow in time, usually. In a thermalizing system, we believe and essentially know that the entanglement entropy grows linearly in time, and one can understand it in various ways. As you evolve it in time, more and more degrees of freedom become entangled. You can think about it as quasi-particles that are going to infinity and carrying entanglement between them because they carry non-local information on the two sides of the interface. As more and more quasi-particles cross the interface, the entanglement grows linearly in time in an unbounded way. So this is a problem for DMRG, because now you need to increase the bond dimension exponentially in time, which means that you have to, your number of, the number of bits you need will grow exponentially in time. But there is an apparent paradox here, and the reason is we expect, I just told you that we expect after a very short time of local thermalization, hydrodynamics should work. Okay? And hydrodynamics is completely classical. So, you know, we're trying to really use a huge hammer to hit a tiny nail here, because why do we need so much entanglement to describe classical hydrodynamics? So that's an apparent paradox. And I can try to make this paradox more explicit by looking at this. I look at it as some kind of information paradox. And it's actually related maybe even to the black hole information paradox. So how many bits I need to encode the state to calculate its dynamics, right? If I compute with DMRG, the number of bits grows exponentially with time, because the entanglement entropy grows exponentially with time, grows linearly in time, so the bond dimension is e to that, and there you go. Okay? On the other hand, I told you that the system thermalizes after some short time, and at very long times, it's just a thermal state. I need very few parameters to describe a thermal state. I just need to know the Lagrange multipliers that fix the conserved quantities, and that's it. And if I go further back in time, I maybe still have to capture some hydrodynamics modes that are relaxing, but it's still classical. It's not nearly this exponentially large number of degrees of freedom that I need to capture. So let's postulate that actually I don't really need this entanglement. So all the entanglement beyond some scale associated with the thermalization time, I can convert the thermalization time with some thermalization length, or maybe coherence length at some finite temperature. This entanglement that I try to compute is really useless. It doesn't carry any, that's a postulate. It doesn't carry any useful information that will feed back to local degrees of freedom. Maybe it's correct and maybe it's not, but at least to try to overcome this information barrier, let's postulate it and see what happens. And then the question becomes, how do we truncate this entanglement without sacrificing the information about the hydrodynamic variables, about the variables we're actually interested in at long times? So I'll just tell you briefly, one naive way that we thought we would be able to do that. It failed, but it's somewhat instructive, and then I'll show you what is the correct way, I think, to do that. So the naive way would be, let's use DMRG and calculate time-dependent DMRG. What time-dependent DMRG does, it every time you basically evolve this matrix product state, it increases the bond dimension. At some point, the bond dimension becomes too large that you can't keep it in your memory, so you truncate by doing SVD, if you singular value decomposition. But what the reason people don't calculate for a long time is that at some point the algorithm tells them that when you truncate the bond dimension, this is the size of the matrix, you're throwing singular values that are already pretty big, and that's called the big truncation error. So at least the naive assumption was that this error just tells me that my state is becoming orthogonal to the exact state. But that's inevitable. If I'm doing an approximation in many-body theory, I'll always have orthogonality catastrophe with the exact state. But that doesn't mean that I won't capture the local operators correctly. And the postulate was that if the bond dimension is sufficiently large to capture this entanglement over a thermal coherence length, then this would be fine, and DMRG, and I can ignore the truncation error. Now, this fails, but the reason this fails is kind of interesting. It fails because this projection back into the bond dimension goes up and you truncate back is very violent, and every time you do it with large truncation error, it also doesn't conserve energy. when you have a problem with energy conservation, there is no way you're going to find hydrodynamics, because it all relies on the energy being conserved. So it does sacrifice information on local observables. Fortunately, there is a way to do the same thing while conserving energy and all other conservation laws that are important, at least the ones that are important.
Is it possible to not conserve energy but then to conserve the other densities?
That is possible with TBD, for example. It's much more complicated than to do it with the variational approach. So you can. So if you do Floquet, for example, I know that there are algorithms that conserve particle number, but it's actually not so easy to do that within TBD as well. So you need to make a big effort to do that. Well, in this approach that I'll talk about, it's essentially automatic. So the idea here is, instead of applying usual unitary evolution to a MPS and then truncating back, the idea is to use the matrix product state, MPS's matrix product state, as a variational state and use the time-dependent variational principle. So the time-dependent variational principle, in principle, it basically means that you can build this Lagrangian. So if I have a variational state, it's general, not only for matrix product states, it's, I think, called Dirac variational principle. I can always build this classical Lagrangian. These states have to be sufficiently complete, but then I can write this variational Lagrangian. It's a classical Lagrangian. You see, it's a functional of all the variational parameters. And now the Euler Lagrange equations of this Lagrangian become your time dependence. Okay, so basically you've converted the problem into some classical evolution within the variational space. It's basically the quantum evolution projected onto the tangent space of the state that you're in now, in the variational manifold. And it's nonlinear. It's generally nonlinear. And so it generates some very complicated classical nonlinear dynamics and will, in general, be chaotic. The nice thing is that there is a very nice and efficient algorithm that these people showed to propagate these states in variationally. So if you do time-dependent DMRG in this way, our claim is then you can ignore truncation errors and you can just run for a long time if your bond dimension is sufficiently large. So our control parameter, which enlarges the variational manifold, is the bond dimension. As we increase chi, we become more and more exact. In principle, if chi is exponentially large, it's actually e to the L over 2, then we're capturing the exact dynamics. Okay? It's just a way to capture the exact dynamics then. Then the Euler-Lagrange equation is simply the Schrodinger equation. Okay, so let's see what we get from this. So just a few comments. So what this time-dependent variational principle, TDVP, did, it converts the unitary evolution to some non-linear classical evolution. Instead of entanglement growth, you get entropy generation by this classical chaos in the variational space. And hydrodynamics is guaranteed to emerge because this time-dependent variational principle actually conserves all the local conservation, all the locally conserved currents in your. So it really is a conservative approximation, including energy, essentially trivially, because energy, it's Hamiltonian evolution generated by the classical Hamiltonian. So it conserves that. So we get hydrodynamics for free, essentially. The only question is whether the transport coefficients this model will, this approximation will give, will be correct. The nice thing is that we can check, because it becomes exact when log chi is L over 2. But we hope that we don't need to go that far, right? When log chi equals L over 2, that's exponentially large chi. It's not good. But we hope that we only need to go to some finite scale, let's call it the thermal correlation length, for convergence of these properties. Um, me try to because something is not working here. Oh, too violent. Okay, came back. Okay. Okay. Okay, yeah, so now it works, great. Okay, so now I'm going to try it on a test model. So we're going to try to calculate quantum dynamics of a spin system. It's an Ising model with, this is the Ising coupling, a transverse field, and it's a quantum spin model and a longitudinal field. And the way we do it is we take an ensemble of initial states. The initial states are random matrix product states. Now we apply some operator S plus to the middle of the system. What this does is that all, you know, everywhere it's random, but in the middle of the system you have a spin up, okay? Because you apply this operator. Now to characterize the hydrodynamics, we monitor the relaxation of the spin SZ and the energy relaxation at the center site. So we want to see how this goes. And in fact, this, ensemble of random matrix product states is like treating an infinite temperature ensemble. We can, before applying this variational real-time evolution, we can apply some imaginary time evolution to generate a finite temperature ensemble. So we can also use this for finite temperature. All the results I'll show now, because it's much easier to do, are for infinite temperature. We're still getting hydrodynamics and hydrodynamic variables like the diffusion constant is non-trivial in these strongly coupled models. So here is an example of a run where we start, instead of starting for random matrix product states, we start from random product states of the spins. So for every realization, our state is non-entangled initially, but as you see, as a function of time, it gets more and more entangled linearly in time. But then there is a saturation that depends. It's not a physical saturation. It's a saturation because of the bond dimension. And as you go to larger bond dimension from 2 to 16, the saturation is at a higher value. It's limited by log of chi. Okay, that's exactly what you see here. Different bond dimensions. This is kind of a sanity check that what happens is what we expect to happen. It's, you know, if you look at bond dimension 2, it captures only log 2 entanglement. That's maximum. Log 2 of 2, sorry. Okay, so now let's look at the relaxation of a spin. So we start with spin up in the middle and see how it relaxes. You see that it relaxes very fast. So the first thing to note is that it relaxes very fast and the bond dimension almost doesn't matter. It relaxes exactly in the same way, regardless of the bond dimension, and the system simply doesn't care about the how much entanglement entropy we have. So this is nice. And another thing you see, interestingly here, there is a very, very long time tail here that has some power law, and the power happens to be exactly 1 over square root of 2 of t, which is exactly what you expect from diffusion. Now, it might seem a bit weird to you because this is an Ising model and there is no conservation of spin, so why is the spin diffusing? The reason it's diffusing is that there is a non-zero overlap between the spin in this Ising model. There is no spin symmetry, actually. There is an overlap between the spin and the energy in this model. So there is a small overlap and it relaxes until it feels that, okay, there is a part of me that can't relax. It can only relax slowly with diffusion. So this is this diffusive tail you see. And first time we saw it, we were very happy. You know, we see not only diffusive tail in conserved quantities, but even in quantities that have an overlap with a conserved quantity, as should be. Okay, but if we look at the actual energy relaxation, it looks even more beautiful. So this is the diffusive tail, and over many, many decades and orders of magnitude, and you see that almost no change except for some noise when we go from to different bond dimensions. And you can further extract from this a diffusion constant. And you see how the diffusion constant depends on the bond dimension, starting from 1, 2, 4, 8. And you see that really after bond dimension 2, really there is no significant change. All the changes happen because of some noise that we didn't really take care of very well. It captures very nicely the emergent relaxation. How much time do I have?
5, 6, 7 minutes.
Okay. So the upshot of this, it captures diffusion very well. This is what we set out to capture, the hydrodynamics. Now we got a little bit more brave and we wanted to ask whether we can capture the a diagnostic of chaos in the system. So how do we diagnose chaos? I gave you the out of time order correlations before, but this happens to be complicated and not very ambiguous to, and partially ambiguous actually to calculate using this method. So we actually cooked up a different diagnostic of chaos that happens to be very closely related to out of time order correlations. Actually, there was a recent paper by Shenke Xu, I think, I'm not sure if he's here now, that showed that direct relation between this measure of chaos and many and out of time order correlations. I think it's kind of a cute measure. So we have two states. I represent them here as matrix product states like that, okay? These are the matrices, they're product of them, and these are the physical sites coming out. And we take part of the system and trace out the rest, that gives us a reduced density matrix of the system, of the partial system. Now we apply a perturbation, unitary perturbation to the left side of one state and not to the other state. Okay, and then let them evolve in time. And what we check is how the reduced density matrices of a large chunk of the system that does not include this perturbation, how does that evolve in time? How does the difference, the distance between these two reduced density matrices evolve in time? So you can think of this as very closely related to the classical measure of chaos. How do we, two classical states in phase space diverge exponentially from each other. Now these are two reduced density matrices. And here, the problem of the fact, there is no problem because these reduced density matrices are not undergoing unitary evolution, so they can depart from each other. So compare this to this, this is very similar, right? It's how two classical states depart in phase space. So this is what we compute, and So this is what happened. So this is a color map of this. So we apply the perturbation here at time t equals zero, and we see how this distance in log scale propagates in time and space. And you see that if I look at what is space is where I make this cut. Okay, if I make it this cut far from the perturbation, then this object will see the difference only when the signal reaches, okay? So this is that signal, and you see how it propagates like a, you know, ballistically. These are cuts at equal times, different times as a function of space. How you see how it climbs from zero to one, actually the log climbs from very small to zero. So now we try to see the velocity. We subtract minus vt. You see that it doesn't collapse it yet. Oh, to collapse it, you need to also divide by square root of t. You need to rescale by square root of t, which actually means that these original fronts are not just traveling at a constant velocity v. They're also broadening diffusively. Okay, and interestingly, there's been toy model for propagation of chaos using random unitaries, and that random unitary model can be solved exactly, and it gives a front that propagates ballistically and broadens diffusively. So this agrees with this toy model, but this is actually, this toy model doesn't conserve energy or anything. This is really done for a specific microscopic model. It's interesting. It's kind of disconcerting because our original idea was that this method should work for all local observables, but now I'm computing this reduced density matrix of more than half the system size. It's a highly, highly non-local structure, and still we get the chaos correctly. I didn't show you, but there is even better convergence with bond dimension than there was for the local quantities. So the question is, what's going on? I think what I don't know, really, and actually, if you want to talk to me, I have some ideas, but we can discuss that. In short, I can say that this is a classical state. We have some kind of fake classical evolution in a very large classical parameter space that has classical chaos. Now, this classical chaos eventually morphs into quantum chaos when the bond dimension is sufficiently large. And it looks like this chaos does not really depend on bond dimension. The classical chaos is independent of how large these matrices are. So we have some, the quantum chaos is actually built of some classical building blocks. That's what it looks like. So we can discuss it, but we have some work on that too. But okay, I want to show you another quick application. I don't know if I have much time. It's an application, so that would be too fast maybe for non-experts, but this is an application to the critical slowing down of transport near the many-body localization transition. And in fact, what we once predicted from using an RG approach is that near the many-body localization transition, instead of just the diffusion constant vanishing continuously at this point, instead of that, what will happen is that you will not have diffusion at all. You'll have some subdiffusive transport with a different, so length scale will be related to time to some exponent alpha, and this exponent, which is the inverse of the dynamical exponent, if you want, will vanish continuously at the transition. And this is the type of transition you expect. And the reason for it is actually kind of simple. It has to do with rare localized region in your thermal bulk. And these rare regions will cause exponentially large delay in the transport, and together it will modify this, it will act to modify this exponent and make a Griffith exponent. And this has been seen in numerics nicely. But there was actually a question raised by experiment. It looked like it works too well, because these experiments are not using random disorder. They're using the experiments are using quasi-periodic disorder, and still it looks like there is this Griffith, there are these Griffith effects. And DMRG calculations that could only go for short times also show this subdiffusive behavior as you go towards the critical point, even when you use quasi-periodic disorder where there are no rare regions. So we wanted to sort this out. So we compared, we could go to very long times. We compared truly random disorder and quasi-periodic system. And in fact, what you can see is, it's hard to see the difference here. I'll show it in the next slide. It's more, these are relaxations. Different slopes in this log-log curve correspond to different exponents that continuously go to zero. Okay, this is exactly this Griffith effect. If you look at the quasi-periodic, if you look at short times, the times that have been calculated in experiment, you see the same kind of fan. But if you look at longer times, you see that all these plots then curve downward and become diffusive at long times. So it looks like this quasi-periodic systems appear to give you Griffith effects or anomalous diffusion, but it's just a crossover, and it crosses over to true diffusion. And here it maybe is a little bit clearer. This is the dynamical exponent, inverse dynamical exponent in weak disorder. Even for at long times, you get an exponent that is different than half. While here you start with an exponent that's different from half, but then they all shoot up and converge at half. So, oops, what happened? So that's my last slide. I just want to summarize and show you the outlook. So, okay, I forgot the summary slide, but I do have an outlook. Oh, what happened to this? So just to summarize, I showed you why there are actually interesting, puzzling results about quantum transport. I showed you maybe new showed you why it's hard to calculate quantum transport, and a new method, at least in one dimension, seems to work well to compute strongly transport in strongly coupled systems, and maybe even the chaos in strongly coupled systems. And the outlook is to, first of all, try to go to lower temperatures where it will be harder to compute because the thermalization time will become larger and larger, which means that we'll need, in order to capture the correct dynamics, we'll need to capture entanglement over a larger scale. And that, of course, will require going to larger bond dimensions to converge. It's not going to necessarily be easy. Another is, I see that it's something that we already started to do, explore the many-body localization transition. I showed you preliminary results. And probably the most interesting, but the maybe hardest thing to do is to extend the method to two-dimensional systems. And so far, we tried to do it with two-dimensional tensor networks. And I have to say, there are major obstructions to do that. But from the insights we have, it's not necessary to use tensor networks. In principle, you need variational states that capture entanglement over short scales and are not really and conserve all the conserved quantities you want. And recently, we have started playing around with variational states that are inspired by neural networks in order to capture the entanglement at short scales and do it in a way that does not really give you a big overhead for going to higher dimensions. I can't tell you yet how well that works because we don't have results. Okay, thank you.
In your quantum chaos slide, were you explaining the analogy to classical chaos?
Right.
Could you just really quickly explain your definition of the reduced entropy matrices again? So yeah, this next slide.
Oops. Right.
So here, yeah. Just so you have the trace of these two. But you said you don't time evolve one?
Yeah, I evolve both of them. Okay, both of them are evolved. So I have two states. Let's take two random states, two states that are exactly the same. So I drew them from some ensemble. I got two states. They're both exactly the same state. So there are two copies of each other. And I apply an operator, SX, for example, some operator to one of them and not to the other, and then start to evolve them in time. Okay, and then I want to see how different the two reduced density matrices are. Okay, so at first they will not be very different because I made some change here. Because it's unitary, it's local, it's not going to make any difference here. But as time goes on, this operator will grow and will start to make a change here. It's basically similar to the out-of-time order correlations. It's because of this growth of the operator. It will make a change here, and these two reduced density matrices will start to become further and further apart. That will grow further apart, yeah. There is something actually quite mysterious here that has to do with dynamics in higher dimensions, because there is another way to view all this, which is if you take the full density matrix of your system, the full density matrix undergoes some unitary evolution. So the two full density matrices of these two states always stay close to each other. Always. Now, looking at the reduced density matrix, you can think of what you do is you take the distance between the two density matrices and project them onto a lower space, which is the Hilbert space of only the states of one side, say. And this projected object now has dynamics that allow it to grow. When you take a projection of unitary evolution, it doesn't look unitary. So that's a
Let me ask a question. So so there's two extremes, many body localization and then thermalization and chaos. Is there anything in between?
I think that's one of the one interesting open question. It's nothing that is, solidly known now, but I don't think there is anything that forbids something in between. Now, there is, even when you take thermalization, there are different classes. There are systems that thermalize fast, like SYK model has this, it's an example of a model that has the fastest scrambling time possible. And then there are these Griffith phases that are extremely, extremely slow. So you can, you can classify them sharply by some exponent or some. So there are these things in between, but still you can, it's still yes or no, thermalized or not thermalized. And we don't know of a specific model we can definitely say has something in between. And robust. Well, there are these integrable models where maybe they are in between, if you want. But as far as we know, they're not robust. Maybe there is something that's quasi-integrable.
Any other questions? Okay.
Yes. That's a very good question. So if the chaotic system is much larger than the many body localized systems, if they're comparable, then this question was actually analyzed nicely. I don't know if completely. And you can have it either way. And I'll give an example of how it could happen. It can either one thermalize the other, or it cannot be in the between, as far as we know, but it can be a situation where either one of them thermalizes the other and they become thermalized, which is the easier, so thermalization is stronger in some sense. But it could also be, for very strong interactions between them, so imagine that one of them is thermalizing because it's a weakly interacting fermion system, but the other is a many-body localized, say, spin system. And now you make interactions between them. Suddenly, once the interactions are strong, then these weakly interacting fermions feel very, very strong disorder on the localized particles of the other system, and then they localize. So that's the example that was given, where the bath can be localized by the chaotic system can be localized by the MBL system, but I don't know of an example where it would give you something in between. Then it will be a critical point. And the question is whether this critical point can open to a phase. Now, one way we tried to address this is, I didn't talk about it because actually I talked about this exactly 3 years ago. We had a RG approach to describe the many-body localization phase transition. And it's kind of a phenomenological RG. So we don't know, it doesn't describe all many-body localized systems. Maybe it doesn't describe any of them, but it does find a very sensible fixed point. Unstable fixed point, but it doesn't find any kind of extended phases. But that doesn't mean that you can't construct some other models which will have it. Yeah.
One last question, or? Yeah?
Good question. I think it's not a Fibonacci chain. It's very similar to a Fibonacci chain. The experiment itself was done on a Rydberg system that has a constrained Hilbert space, which is sort of like a Fibonacci chain. But these scars, I think they're not related to localization. The system will eventually thermalize. It just has an special states that have very... It's a very... maybe there is some reason why this state, even in the thermodynamic limit, will be a state with an area law entanglement and not thermalizing. But it could be that it's just a very, very long-lived state. It's like a resonance, but it actually, when you take the system to be sufficiently long and you look at sufficiently long times, then it will decay. And I think that is the prevalent, you know, view of this. Also, the scar also means classically you have a very small, you have a periodic orbit, but going out of this periodic orbit has a positive Lyapunov exponent, so you go out of it, but very, very slowly. So if you make this quantum mechanical, you'll find something that is maybe very long lived, but it will decay after a while. So I think the prevalent view is that it's not really a non-thermalizing system.
Okay, Ehud, thank you once again for a really great talk.